The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Wall Street ended lower on Friday, weighed down by tech stocks after a stronger-than-expected jobs report torpedoed recent optimism that the Federal Reserve might ease up on its aggressive campaign against high inflation. The Dow closed with a near quarter of a percent gain, while the S&P 500 ended down fractionally and the tech-heavy NASDAQ fell half a percent. Data on Friday showed U.S. employers hired far more workers than expected in July, taking the air out of investors' hopes that the Fed might let up on its interest rate hikes.
Chinese missiles began striking the seas north, south, and east of Taiwan hours after U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi left the island. Chinese state television released video of warships patrolling the Taiwan Strait as fighter jets cruised the skies above, air cover for the multiple no-go danger zones declared by China in some of the busiest shipping lanes in the world.
China has chosen to overreact and use Speaker Pelosi's visit as a pretext to increase provocative military activity in and around the Taiwan Strait.
China sees Taiwan as a breakaway province which will eventually come under Beijing's control and is deeply opposed to any visits by foreign governments.
I actually think this will be the new normal. And keep in mind, for the last year and a half, China has been staging what has been the most sustained show of force in the Taiwan Strait in more than a generation. All of these cases, China has used demonstrations of force to signal its resolve, and I expect that to continue for the foreseeable future.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
A blowout jobs report helped to alleviate fears of a recession, but led to a jump in the futures market to price in another 75 basis point hike by the Fed this September. The market has staged a strong rally off of its June lows, but our technician today, John Roque, at 22V Research, thinks it's getting close to stalling out. Later in the program, Jim Poplava speaks with Greg Orrell at the OCM Gold Fund, who says that precious metals and precious metal mining stocks are seeing a major flush out before the next final move. Jim and Greg also talk about the massive premium that currently exists for those attempting to purchase silver bullion and what's happening in the physical bullion market. Lastly, in today's big picture segment, Jim discusses his most recent client newsletter, reiterating his outlook that we are still in a long-term commodity bull market. All of that coming up in today's show, but first, here's Ryan Poplava on what moved the markets this week.
Some of the key drivers this week were the economic reports, including the jobs report Friday for July, and some Fed speak that has tempered some of the sentiment the Fed will let up on its aggressive stance towards raising rates that has caused stocks to rally as strongly as they have these past few weeks. So let's start with the later. There was a significant reversal in long-term Treasury yields this week based on two catalysts. One was on Tuesday when San Francisco Fed President Mary Daly, a voter in 2024, said the Fed is nowhere near being almost done in fighting inflation, which echoed some earlier comments from Minneapolis Fed President Neil Kashkari, a voter in 2023, who had these comments to say.
Well, we definitely want to see some slowing. We don't want to see the economy overheating. We would love it if we can transition to a sustainable economy without tipping the economy into recession. There's not a great record of doing that. Typically, when the economy slows down, it slows down by quite a bit, especially if it's the central bank that is inducing the slowdown. So we're going to do everything we can to try to avoid a recession, but we are committed to bringing inflation down, and we are going to do what we need to do. And we are a long way away from achieving an economy that is back at 2% inflation, and that's where we need to get to.
So Daly and Kashkari mainly in consensus here, and it was Daly's comments Tuesday that caused a huge reversal in long-term rates, which touched 2.53% and finished up at 2.74% at the close. While we're talking about treasuries, it was the hot jobs report on Friday that cemented the comments from Kashkari that the Fed will likely need to continue to be aggressive on rates given payrolls were as strong as they were. Non-farm payrolls increased 528,000 in July, with hourly earnings up 5.2% year-over-year, and unemployment is at 3.5%. The participation rate, which significantly has dropped again, showing there are fewer people available as workers. It was the consensus Friday that the Fed will not have any opportunity to slow down on its fight against inflation. After the jobs data Friday, the probability of a 75 basis point hike in September shot up from 34% to 64.5%, according to CME's FedWatch tool. After the release of the jobs report, the 10-year yield shot up as well from 2.7% to 2.85%. Despite the weak economic numbers that have pushed the 10-year yield low as it was over the past month, Daley's comments and the jobs number data did a lot in 2 days to change that path. Stocks have remained largely resilient to the idea the Fed could continue to be aggressive this week based on the Fed speak and jobs data. There are two scenarios I'm hearing that may be the reason why selling hasn't resumed. The strength in the jobs market is showing that while there may be some industries that are slowing, the jobs market remains strong due to low participation rates, can largely do fine despite the Fed raising rates. Secondly, given there is a lag to the Fed's rate increases and its effect on employment, which is a lagging indicator, there's the idea that we will see weaker economic numbers in the future that will allow the Fed to be less aggressive. My issue with both of these two lines of thinking is that I don't believe in a soft landing recession. A conventional recession will create its own psychological momentum, and we've seen that play out over the past 100 years. Weak numbers will eventually affect the way companies hire. We're seeing that now, which will then cause more unemployment and a decrease in demand. This is the goal the Fed is aiming for because that's the only means it has to fight inflation. Structural inflation on the supply side is out of their hands. Kashkari's comments early in the week highlight the Fed's thinking on these very items, which corroborates these views. And I think the stock market rising 10% in the face of the Fed's aims to lower demand to fight inflation will just encourage more comments from the likes of Kashkari and Daley and other members in the weeks to come. Looking over at another area of the financial markets that's seen some changes is in oil. Oil prices had risen early in the week on reports OPEC has agreed to a smaller production increase of 100,000 barrels per day for September versus the July and August when 600,000 barrels were added. The price of West Texas hit $96 a barrel on that news, but due to a build in inventories, that was reversed this week. The EIA reported a build of 4.47 million barrels versus the prior week's draw and gasoline inventories, which rose 163,000 barrels versus the prior week's 3.3 million barrels build. Oil prices fell 3.6% on the news of the build to $90.91 and was at $88.54. Last I checked, trading below a key level of support these past 5 months and now also trading below the 200-day moving average. So two very key technical levels that we would need to get back above for the bullish outlook to improve. That's it for this week's wrap-up, focusing on Fed comments, the rise in rates, the jobs report, and the drop in oil prices, I think, were the key items. It was mainly a flat week in stocks, working off some of the overbought readings from weeks prior for the S&P 500 and the Dow Industrials, while the NASDAQ small and mid-cap stock indices notched another week higher with more than 1% gains to continue the rally there. Up next, John Roque to share with us his technical views, and if it's anything like his report I read on Thursday, really looking forward to it. I think he's got his finger on the pulse of the markets, so stay tuned.
Last month, Taiwan publicly stated that its supersonic missiles can reach Beijing within 15 minutes. That is a significant public announcement. This was taking place while Beijing was pounding the table, we will take back Taiwan, and global media was covering that Taiwan will fall just like Ukraine has fallen. That combined with Indonesia's U.S. joint military exercises involving 12 countries, which include, as I mentioned, Japan, Korea, India, Britain, Australia, as the main players, with Canada, France also included in that mix. The only ally that Beijing has right now is Russia.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says Contact Us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, stock market investors have been getting a bit of reprieve. Stocks have bounced back from hitting a low early in July. Will this rally continue? In other words, is this just a bear market rally? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is John Roque from 22V Research. John, let's begin with the S&P, which has had a nice bounce from the lows that we saw late June. What's your take here? Where's this market headed?
Hey, Jim, thanks for having me on. Pleasure to be with you. So the S&P is up, I guess, about 14% or so in 32 days. And that is not inconsistent with bear market rallies, especially in terms of the time frame. So 32 days is probably lengthier than the averages that I've studied on bear market rallies. So in late June, I sent out a note to clients entitled Yogi Berra Said. And I used Yogi Berra to sort of help me with the market analogy to say that I thought we would be able to rally. And my upside target for the rally was around 4,200, which was really the breakdown level going back to May. And I used another baseball analogy for that one, but I'll spare you the pain of listening to me on that. So we're up and we're overbought on a daily basis, kind of above where we were in March and April and right where we were going back to November of 2021. So for my money, I still think this is a bear market rally, but it would not surprise me if it extended a bit more and got kind of closer to 4,300.
Well, let's talk about something that's in the news. And you wrote a piece on it recently, and that's the price of oil. It's been dropping, especially as the administration drains our strategic oil reserves. And also, John, we're heading into the shoulder months of the year when weather's better, the summer driving season is open. So let's talk about oil and where you think it's going and where does it bottom?
Okay, so what I did was, Jim, thank you for mentioning it. I sent out a note just as a refresher to our clients yesterday. And I had been writing prior to this that I thought that Brent especially was giving better signals than WTI and that I thought that both would work lower. And so I've chosen the December futures contract. So if anybody happens to be on Bloomberg, the symbol is CLZ2. And I thought that the first downside would be 80. And then we should not be surprised, or perhaps I shouldn't be surprised, if it actually got back to what was the breakout level in early January of this year in the low 70s. What I think is especially important to consider is that not only do we have weakness on an absolute basis for the price of oil, both Brent, as I mentioned, and West Texas, the CLZ2 contract, but it is weakening, of course, on an absolute basis, but it is also weakening on a relative basis versus a basket of commodities. And I've chosen the Bloomberg Commodity Spot Index to help me with that relative ratio. And if we go back to 2008, 2012, 2014, 2018, prior to what's occurring now in 2022, those prior four examples occurred where you got absolute peak in price and an absolute peak relative to the Bloomberg Commodity Spot Index. And it suggests to me, because it's weakening both on an absolute basis and relative to its peer group, that it's quite likely that we do see those lower levels I've mentioned.
So, John, as we head into the fall, some of the themes that you've been talking about, and we won't get into the inflation thing, but one is inflation and interest rates are going to be stickier and higher than most expect. Let's talk about that, because we've seen the 10-year Treasury note drop from the low threes. Now it's below 3%, and we've seen the yield curve inverted. So what's your take here?
Okay, so the reason I said that I thought that inflation would be stickier than most believe is because I don't think you can go from 9% on the CPI to 2%, which is the Fed's objective, in a short period of time. For example, if you go back over time, over 72 years, and check the CPI on a year-over-year basis, and I'll dismiss the 1970s into the early 80s for a second. And in the early 50s, inflation peaked on the CPI at 9.4%, so roughly where we are now. It took 13 months before it moved back below 2%. So I don't know necessarily that anybody in the Fed is paying attention to these historical numbers, because every time they speak and talk about inflation, they certainly sound like they're not. And then if we talk about the PPI and go back again over 72 years, the most recent reading in the PPI printed 18.6%, which is the second highest reading in 72 years. And the last time inflation ran this hot via the PPI, it took almost 9 years for the Fed to get the inflation genie back in the bottle. So that's the reason I thought that it was going to take a little bit longer and it would stay stickier. Inflation to stay stickier and a little bit longer for the Fed to achieve their objectives. I just think it's, you know, if the history is prologue, and I know this will not satisfy anybody in statistics class because there are not enough inputs, but we're probably looking at, you know, August of 2023, if the Fed gets everything right, to get it back down to what their 2% target is. So that's what I was mentioning.
So when you look at this, too, we have other factors that are going in. We've got the strategic petroleum reserves, which is helping to keep a cap on oil, at least. And then, but also, John, we've got another new massive spending bill that is coming through. So it reminds me, similar to when President Trump lowered taxes and tried to stimulate the economy at the time, the Fed was raising interest rates, so the two policies were in conflict, as I see the same thing happening now. You've got fiscal policy pumping money into the economy, and you've got monetary policy trying to tighten. How does this play out?
Jim, that's a very good question. And I'm either way too old or I'm getting especially cynical, or perhaps both. But I tend to look at the names of all the bills that come out of the White House or D.C., and I tend to think the exact opposite will occur from the name of that bill. And you mentioned it, of course. It's the Inflation Reduction Act. So I'm going to assume that it's going to be the Inflation Continue to Persist Act. I think that's the way. If they had actually said the bill was going to be to increase inflation, then I would think it would do the exact opposite. But I think the Inflation Reduction Act probably tells us that we should continue to expect that inflation will be, you know, stickier, as I imagine.
So in speaking of inflation, let's talk about commodities. You expect oil to weaken, as we do, especially heading into the fall with the shoulder months. What about other commodities? Let's talk about gold, silver, and some of the base metals. What's going on there?
Okay, so I'm going to give you a full disclosure that I've gotten nothing but agita or aggravation from gold. So when it was trading in the 1800s, I thought that it was going to break and work lower. And then it broke below 1700. I thought it had further risk. And of course, that's wrong because it's gone from, you know, roughly 1680 up $100 since July 21st. Gold is still below what is its, you know, cresting 200-day moving average. So I think it's going to be hard for it to really make great headway. But as I said, I made this last mistake for $100 worth. And I haven't necessarily understood gold's action for some time. You and I spoke about this some months ago. And I think if my memory serves, you know, we talked about this and my line may have been, you know, why can't gold do better? What's the reason? Is it because of dollar strength? Is it because of something else? And, you know, gold is rallying here, but I don't really have much confidence in my ability to read it properly here. So I'm going to politely not give you a better answer, not because I don't want to, just because I'm sure it's not going to be a good one. And then silver is trying to play a little bit of a catch up to gold, but it is in worse technical shape, if you think about it, relative to its own 200-day moving average than gold is.
You know, the amazing thing, though, staying on the topic of silver, if you go and try to buy silver bullion in the form of, let's say, silver eagles, John, the premium on Silver Eagles is about 74-75%. I've never seen anything like this.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, this it's very curious to me, based on what you said, Jim, that we could still have a languishing, you know, spot silver price. It is very curious, and it's telling me that there are inputs here that I certainly don't have a handle on and not close to understanding.
So let's talk about some of the themes that you've outlined in a recent newsletter. You talk about sell rallies, buy dips. In short, all this sounds ridiculous, but don't buy good patterns. Explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, so I am traditionally a base and breakout guy because I think that the base and breakout increases the odds of my success. And I think I don't have as much success with other particular technical setups. And the example that I used and that you kindly referenced, with what you just said right here, was Solar Edge Technologies. And Solar Edge had built itself pretty nice through May, June, and then into late July, and then had two upside gaps quickly that took the stock from 350 to, you know, just about 375. And then yesterday it was down 20%. And I know today the stock is up, you know, quite sharply. It's up 6% today, but down 20% yesterday. So still, if you had bought that kind of breakout gap, you're suffering. And my point of this for saying that is that this action for Solar Edge, where you base upside gap, two of them, and then have a 20% downside gap, is not characteristic of bull market action. It's characteristic of, you know, let's say bear market or difficult market action. So that's why I think it's probably better for me if I don't necessarily put great trust in these beautiful patterns, because you're really not getting paid to buy breakouts here.
Yeah. And speaking of breakouts, let's talk about some of the sectors within the S&P. We've seen a sort of a breakout with consumer discretionary. But John, I'm listening to some of these retail reports. Costco is raising its prices. Target missed its numbers. Walmart really missed its numbers, now laying off 200 executives. And yet we have a breakout here in consumer discretionary. What's going on here?
So consumer discretionary, Jim, you know, is up very sharply off the lows. You're absolutely right. It's up 27%. And it is coming into, again, a downward sloping 200-day moving average. So I don't know that this is going to be a great buy here because you're getting closer to resistance. I would also tell you that Amazon is clearly the biggest stock in this group. So it is certainly driving the returns for this sector over the last few weeks because Amazon weighs so much and is certainly up sharply over the last month. Just in the last, since July 1st, Amazon is up 30%. Tesla is up 35%. So those are, you know, the two biggest stocks in that group, and they're driving a lot of the returns. But I'm curious that these items are rallying despite the bad news. Now, if we wanted to be contrary opinion thinkers here, we might say, well, they are rallying despite the bad news. Perhaps they're telling us that the news might not get worse. But I don't know that necessarily that's the right takeaway here.
Yeah, because Amazon reported they lost money in the first quarter for the first time in 7 years. All the retailers are reporting a buildup in inventory, declining margins, and consumers switching their buying habits. You're seeing this in grocery stores where well-known brands are being ignored and consumers are going to like store brands that are much cheaper. So everybody's trying to save a buck here.
They certainly are. And maybe that's another reason that Amazon is likely to do better going forward, because people will try to use the Amazon services to try to find lower prices. So I don't know that I have a better answer than the one you've just expressed, but I know the stock's up sharply in a short period of time and it's coming into its downward sloping 200-day or 40-week moving average. And usually that presents some measure of difficulty. So perhaps at least I will have a better idea, perhaps on the next move rather than the one that's already occurred.
So let's talk about interest rates. We've seen the 10-year come down. You're also, we've seen utilities starting to break out. In fact, I think that's a sector you're recommending. Let's talk about those two.
Okay, so I think that the 10-year yield is likely to work lower. And I expect that the yield curve will continue to invert because I think twos will stay stickier than tens. I think it's important to consider the following. And what I think is going to happen when the Fed raises rates again, raises the Fed funds rate again, is that the Fed funds will move above its 2019 high and move to a, what would be what we would call a higher high relative to its prior high. And that's the first time it would have done that since the year 2000. So I think that likely says to me that perhaps the rates will stay a little bit stickier and higher than we have become used to since the GFC, because we'll be making that higher high. And then I actually like the action in the utility group, because there continues to be, you know, a nice uptrend that has not been violated, and that the group continues to build what I think is a big base. And it is curious to me, despite the fact that rates moved up sharply through 2021 into 2022, that this group, the utility group, did not really correct that much. In fact, on a historical basis, relative to other bear market declines for the utility group, where it went down in 93 into 94, almost 30%, and then during the big 01-02 decline, 64, and then in the GFC, it went down 50%. But in the 18 period, 2018, it was only down 16%. And then this time, it was only down 17%, and despite the fact that rates were going up. So I am questioning, why could it have done so well in the face of rising rates? And certainly, I don't have the fundamental narrative to finish my own question here. But it's enough to make me say to perhaps clients or investors that I speak with that we should be looking at this group a little bit more closely, because perhaps there's something that will be occurring that we're not yet aware of.
So, John, as you're looking at this rally and you're expecting it to fade, what would be the signs that are telling you that? Let's say volume recedes, it stalls. What other signs are you looking at here?
Well, I'm paying very close attention to the top five weighted stocks in the S&P. Through earlier today, the top five weighted stocks were 22.4% of the S&P and up about 50% since year-end 2019. They're weighting in the S&P. And the top 10 stocks are now at a new high of 29% in the S&P 500. So because they're so weighty, both the top five and the top 10, I would believe that these stocks would have to show some measure of retracement or retrenchment or weakness for the overall market to have a more difficult time. But as long as these two groups, the top five and the top 10, of course, we know it's one group entirely. If these stocks stay firm or secure, then I think it's going to be very difficult to get the market in a lot. The market tended to be weakest over the first 6 months or so when these stocks started to come in importantly. But if they don't come in again, then I think the market will be fairly secure. It is remarkable to me, however, that they can be bigger than they were at the end of 2021, when I thought it was a good time to reduce these stocks.
So, John, as you look at this, what would be, I guess, a final question, as you expect this to be sort of a choppy, volatile market, at what point, if you were looking at a real bottom in stocks, what kind of things would you like to see? Because you have a lot of people on cable channels that are coming out and saying the bottom is in, stocks are out, you need to get fully on board and invest. I don't buy that argument, but in your mind, what would you like to see that would confirm that we have hit the bottom?
Okay, first off, I'd like to answer it as follows. If you and I went back to the early 1900s and we took the Dow Jones Industrial Average and we created a very simple query in Excel, and we asked the question, what happens to the Dow 1 year forward from any price in history? We would find that the Dow is up, no matter what the day is in history, 1 year forward, about 68% of the time. The only time it's not up 1 year forward is either if you're in a bear market or you're in a recession. So if we can figure that the market is up nearly 7 out of 10 instances 1 year forward from any day in history, well, by and large, we should always be buyers on pullbacks. The rub is whether or not we're in a bear market or in a recession. So I still think that that's a question. Number two is, it is quite odd to me that there's really only one answer for everything, and that's always to buy. And I know that's been especially right since the GFC low, because the Fed kept rates artificially low for a long period of time. I think that dynamic has changed, and that suggests to me that we should probably be a little bit more vigilant with respect to, just embracing every particular bullish call. I actually think it's when you mentioned that guys or strategists or commentators, the media, et cetera, mentioned that the market will be higher 1 year out. I mean, that's on the surface so self-effacing and so self-evident that it is almost not worth mentioning. I think it's probably more important to mention the fact that, 30% of the time it's not up 1 year later because of the recession or bear market. So a long-winded way of saying, I think we might actually see that the market will be sideways from here and not necessarily up to a new all-time high. And I think the sideways action will be more indicative of a grinding, difficult period rather than an up and to the right period.
I agree with you. I think the recession that we're in, I believe, right now, and also inflation is going to be a lot stickier. I just don't see it coming down to levels that, the Fed would be comfortable. In other words, their 2% target range. I just don't see that in the next 12 months.
Well, Jim, I would just like to say one more thing. I think, and I say this, of course, somewhat critically, but I won't be profane when I say it. I think that professional economists don't necessarily do a great job forecasting. And Jim Bullard was on CNBC yesterday, and he was questioned by Joe Kernan. And I thought Joe Kernan did a good job on the interview. He said to him, he talked to him and said, you guys had missed the inflation call by a ton. I'm paraphrasing. And Bullard kind of laughed it off, and he said, "What's the matter? You don't believe our forecasting models?" and I think the answer is yes. And then I don't know if you or your listeners heard this, but yesterday, the San Francisco Federal Reserve President, Mary Daly, who makes $423,000 a year, said the following: "I don't feel the pain of inflation anymore. I see prices rising, but I have enough. I sometimes balk at the price of things, but I don't find myself in a space where I have to make trade-offs because I have enough. And many Americans have enough." I think when you promote easy money policies and you make $423,000 a year, that's the kind of response you give. And I think with a response like that, it probably means that we should consider whether the San Francisco Fed should be open at all, because that really shows that she is tremendously out of touch with rank and file Americans. And I said this more than a year ago. It was in the spring of 2021. I made an open invitation to the Federal Reserve President, Chairperson Jay Powell, or anybody on the FOMC to accompany me to Webster Avenue in the Bronx so they could tell the good people there why higher prices were in their best interests. Suffice it to say, I didn't think anybody would respond to my invitation, and they didn't. And I doubt that they will ever visit the Bronx to tell people there why higher prices were in their best interest. So I think they're out of touch, Jim. That's my humble opinion.
Couldn't agree more. Well, listen, John, as we close, you do some great work. How can people find out more about your company?
So 22V Research is an institutional research company, and it's a macro research shop. So certainly they can look for our comments on our website. But thank you very much for allowing me to say that.
All right, John, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Have a great rest of summer, and I hope to talk to you again in the fall.
We've been saying that things may start looking bad in 2023 and look even worse in 2024, 2025. And I think the world is still on that trajectory. Could a recession come sooner than we thought? Yes, it could come at any time. We've been in a recession in the first half of this year. It's a very short, shallow recession. Our expectation is that growth will be a little bit better in the second half of this year. But the next 18 months, we're looking at pretty anemic growth and gathering economic, financial, and political storms. And that sort of sets the stage for something much worse beyond 2023.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the price of gold has recently gone up nearly $100 an ounce. The stocks are still languishing. Given the inflation rates and what the Fed is doing with interest rates, where is gold heading later this year? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is Greg Orrell. He's manager of the OCM Gold Fund, one of the best performing gold funds. You know, Greg, we were talking just before we went on the air that if you would have told me we'd be looking at the highest inflation rates in four decades, massive amount of debt, a massive amount of fiscal spending, that gold would be languishing as it is today, I would have said you're crazy, but that's exactly where it is. What do you think is going on here and what accounts for that?
Now, Jim, that is, you know, the question that we're getting asked quite a bit. You know, a lot of folks are saying, well, this is exactly why I wanted to hedge my portfolio with gold is, where is the, we're getting inflation, the market's breaking down and you've got a geopolitical, crisis in the Ukraine-Russian war. Gold should be going up. We should be seeing $100 days here. And the bottom line is that, we've been in this bull market in financial assets for a long time. And confidence in central banking, which we thought, was really cracking when, Powell said that, inflation was transitory and, really, skated the notion that it was the monetary origins of inflation. We have really, seen the Fed claw back some of that credibility. And I think there is, based on looking at the market, looking at tips and, prices where, the tips are right now, the market's believing that Fed's doing his job. And Powell has clawed back some of that credibility. And, I still believe there's going to be capitulation by the Fed. But at this point, the market's wanting to believe him because, they want to believe the buy the dip and that the financial asset markets are going to continue to go higher. And, that you can say that, the strong dollar is put pressure on the gold market. Look, that strong dollar is good for, short-term moves in gold price. And if you were to go back 50 years to 1971, when Nixon closed the gold window, pull up a chart of the dollar index and gold, and you'll see the debasement, the fiat currencies, versus gold. The dollar index is just an index versus other depreciating, currencies. So,
well, Greg, let's talk about some of the anomalies that I see in the market, not just gold itself with inflation, but I want to talk about silver. Because if you look at silver, silver got up to about $50. I think it was in 2011, which is where it was in 1980. Inflation adjusted terms, silver has never been this cheap. However, if you want to go someplace and buy silver eagles, in I think it was July 4th weekend, the premiums on silver eagles was over 80% over spot. In your opinion, what's behind that?
Well, one is that there was a big order that came into the silver eagles market. It was a $50 million order, and they cleaned out all the retail and all the wholesale supply in the silver eagles market. And they didn't want any bars or anything else. They just wanted Silver Eagles. The order came out of Texas.
Oh, is that the billionaire lady that's supposedly buying $1 billion?
You know, I don't know the identity of the buyer. I know who the broker was who did the transaction. And I think it's that has a lot to do with it. But you also have to go back to during the whole COVID period where, there was a scramble for physical and, it was difficult to get your hands on it without paying $200 over spot for an American Eagle gold coin or, $3, $4, $5 over spot or more for Silver Eagles. So we have seen strong physical demand. We've seen it in Germany. This German demand for bullion products has been strong for the last 2 years too. And so this really dichotomy between what the sentiment is on the street, Wall Street, and what we're seeing in terms of physical buying, across the globe. So it's a bit of a conundrum when you think about it in those terms of, why is sentiment towards gold assets and precious metal assets, where it's at. One then starts to question and go down the track of, is there some market stability, action going on by central banks? Obviously, if the gold price is running wild, inflationary expectations become unanchored. So it's not a stretch to believe that there is, central bank market stability action that may take place in the gold market.
Well, if we look at the macro factors that would drive gold higher, and I'm thinking of modern monetary theory, which is operational in Washington with both parties, we got this huge stimulus program last year by the administration, $2 trillion, and inflation started to take off. And Greg, you would think they would get the message, but they're trying to push through another $2 trillion. In an Orwellian terms, they're calling it anti-inflationary. But in my mind, this is going to be more inflation in the pipeline.
Yeah. What happened in the 70s, Jim, is that you had these periods where inflation spiked, it came down, then spiked again. And, everything that we have seen for the last 20 plus years has been to socialize risk. And it's very difficult for me to believe that that trend is not going to continue. And so, if you're looking for a catalyst as to when, you're going to see, the gold price and silver price really become unanchored, I think you would have to look at, the next capitulation by the Fed, probably stopping the fight on inflation, before there's enough liquidity drained would, be a likely scenario in my opinion. But the trend is higher debt. And, one of the main theses that I've had for a long time on gold is that, gold is highly correlated to total federal debt outstanding at about 92% over the last 50 years since Nixon closed the gold window. So, that trend, if you are going to go in a recessionary period, that trend is going to continue much higher, as one would think that the deficit spending would increase and, that the total debt would also go up.
As I look at this market, Greg, and you manage a gold fund, so maybe you'll confirm this. I have never seen better values in gold stocks this cheap. I don't care if you're looking at companies like a Newmont or a Barrick. The dividend yields of 4% and 5% in a market where treasuries are under 3%. It's a compelling bargain. And it's not just that. Some of these companies are selling at levels, as recently you talked in your newsletter, for $40 lower today than when gold was trading around $700 in 2007. Explain that.
Yeah. So first off, the gold shares actually performed in the first quarter quite well. And you are up about 15, 16% on the gold indexes. And then a complete sell-off took place. The main theme really became cost inflation, operating cost inflation that the market got scared of, along with the fact that the gold shares were a winner versus, you know, everything else going down. So people started to sell their winners to lock in, you know, those profits as they started to get antsy about, you know, a much, you know, bigger drop in the overall market. So one of the things that we are experiencing in the gold industry right now is, you know, we are seeing definitely some cost inflation. You know, the big, you know, kickoff of that were some operating costs down in Australia that really skyrocketed. You know, a lot of that was specific to Australia in terms of labor and other COVID issues that had piled up after a while. And so, you know, the market became fearful that the shorts piled onto that theme, really pressed everything down, especially on development companies that were, you know, going through a studies to build a mine. You know, they really became the target of short sellers and investors, you know, shunning those assets. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, one of the things, you know, that, you know, I'm looking at now in terms of these development assets and exploration assets, where they've spent the money and the time to drill out reserves. And, you know, those reserves and resources in the ground are trading less than they were, you know, back when gold was less than $700. Actually, I would go back to, you know, in the early 80s, they were trading around that same price. So there's been no appreciation in the market of resources in the ground, even though the gold price has gone from $300 or $400 to over, you know, close to $1,800. So it's pretty amazing. It just shows you how hated the sector has been. You know, granted, some of that was brought on by the sector itself. You know, I always like to say that there was a period there, especially after that last cycle, you know, where they were debasing shareholders' equity faster than the central banks were debasing the currencies. And that became a problem that disenchanted, you know, gold share investors. And that has been the struggle to get, you know, that confidence back in the marketplace.
Well, I mean, if you look at how the industry has changed, I mean, Barrick used to be loaded with debt. They've been paying that down. Newmont just announced they're buying back 5% of their stock. So I haven't seen these kind of values in the sector in such a long time. And to me, I believe, like you, the bullion is going higher. There's just simply too much debt. And I don't think the Fed is going to be as tough as everybody thinks. I mean, they can't, or otherwise they're going to be in a full-blown credit crisis, because we're watching the spreads on, you know, junk debt compared to treasuries. We're seeing not only debt amount, not only at the governmental level, you're seeing it at the corporate level. Consumers added on $1 trillion of debt last year. So we're a debt-based economy. The Fed has got to walk a tightrope here. If they push too hard or push rates too high, they could have a full-blown credit crisis on their hands.
Yeah, Jim, I think that that's exactly the point, is that, you know, you are walking this tightrope. You push it over. You have the systemic risks that are out there. And what have we seen? You know, they've done everything in their power to avoid this cascading sequence of defaults, you know, going back to Greenspan. And that's their greatest fear. They've been fearing deflation because of the level of debt that's out there. And we've seen, you know, this expansion of balance sheets by, you know, 8-10 times by the Bank of Japan, you know, the ECB and the Fed. You know, where is all that credit creation gone? It's gone into financial assets. And so now you have market structure and leverage that's built up that threatens the whole system. And those are the systemic risks that are out there that the Fed has been fighting. And they do not want to tip that over. And so, you know, what's going to be the answer? Well, you know, it's what old Richard Russell used to say, you inflate or die.
Well, it certainly follows monetary theory. I mean, that's what the government did after World War II to bring down our debt levels in relation to the economy. It seems like they're on the same track. Greg, given where you see the markets today and where the values are, to me, I like some of these big cap miners. You're getting dividend yields of 4 or 5%. at a time when rates are far below that. So you're getting paid to wait for the movement. Same thing happened to oil stocks in 2020. We started buying the oil stocks with 5, 6, 7% dividends. Didn't go anywhere for about a year, but then it took off. Could you see the same thing happening to the gold market?
Absolutely. I think that the shorts and investors, they've overplayed this theme of cost inflation. I mean, Newmont obviously signaled that they had, were experiencing some serious cost inflation. But, so it raised, the cost of production over $100, a little over $100 an ounce. What you need to see is the gold price start to accelerate higher, so those margins expand. And, so maybe Newmont and Barrick are seeing a little, as two of the larger producers globally, are seeing a, that 10% to 20% inflation on their cost lines. But when you look at, companies like Endeavor Mining, which reported today, and Agnico Eagle, Alamos, these companies are keeping their costs, relatively in check. And, there are things that, these miners can do to try to, counteract some of this inflation that's going on the cost side. Talking to a lot of them, they do believe that, from a consumable standpoint, at least it has paused for the moment, that it's stabilized, from their cost increases. And some of them are actually trying to claw some of the cost increases back. Just like anything, when you get inflationary expectations, the suppliers also start increasing their costs, their prices in order to stay in front of their costs. So it becomes that vicious cycle.
So, Greg, given where you see the markets right now, would you be buying bullion? Would you be buying the stocks? Where would you be heading? Or maybe a bit of both?
I'm still a believer in both. There's always, you have to think about the miners themselves. They represent leverage to the bullion price, that operating leverage. And that's what the market's questioning right now, is that operating leverage, because of what they feel is, some of that margin compression from costs. But, in a rising gold market, in the environment that I see going forward, costs do stabilize, and the gold price really starts to accelerate dramatically. And in that environment, the gold shares will stand out versus the rest of the market. There'll be increasing margins, just like how the energy companies have looked here of late, versus the broader market. And so I go along with you in believing that, sometimes you get flushed out right before you start to, have the big moves. And I believe that's where we are on the miners. I really do believe that, we're going to see dramatic increases. The market's going to start to come back and appreciate that there has been capital discipline. These, as you pointed out, the balance sheets are so much better. They understand that, in a depleting resource business, you have to let shareholders participate in the cash flow. If you don't, it becomes a bit of a fool's game of let's just get bigger and bigger just for the sake of management. So the fact that they're now, recognize that, participation and capital payback to shareholders is important. But, understanding that you still have to reinvest in growth. I believe that the industry's never been in better shape, really.
So, Greg, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the gold fund that you run, tell them how they can do so, please.
Well, it's the OCM Gold Fund. You can go to OCMGoldFund.com. You can go on most of the platforms that, the national brokerages, through Fidelity, TD, and also on Schwab. So it's very accessible. So OCMAX is the ticker. If they need to give us a call at the office, they can do that. That information is also on the website, OCMGoldFund.com.
All right. Well, listen, Greg, thanks for joining us on the program. Have a great rest of the summer and come back again.
Jim, you just wrote a major piece for clients, The Big Disconnect, looking at paper markets versus the physical markets, which is going to be the subject of today's big picture discussion. And there's been growing fears over U.S. and global recession, not to mention a continually strengthening dollar, which has put a large amount of pressure on the commodity complex in recent months after a very strong move to new all-time highs on many commodities. But if you wouldn't mind kick things off for us, why do you believe this is a shorter-term pullback in the midst of a much larger bull market cycle for commodities as a whole?
Well, there's a couple of things that we see, Chris, from a macro perspective. If you take a look at, we were heavily involved in the commodity bull market in the 00 decade. The catalyst for commodities back then was, well, number one, it was almost a two-decade-long bear market cycle. I don't care if you were looking at oil, you were looking at gold. Commodities were in the dumps for almost two decades. But then along came China. And as China began to industrialize, they created this huge demand for commodities because the West was outsourcing much of our manufacturing to China. It became a manufacturing powerhouse. And of course, as you manufacture, they were consuming large, vast amounts of commodities. Fast forward to where we are today, there's some skepticism about China's economy. But what I think the big driver is going to be for commodities in this decade is going to be ESG. As the world goes more towards green, as we push more and more towards EVs, whether it's windmills, whether it's solar panels, electric cars, all of that requires vast amounts of commodities. You take a combustion car and you compare that to an EV will use six times the amount of commodities, especially copper. So all of this is going to create a demand for commodities. And unfortunately, I would say you probably have to go back to 2014, at least for oil, but also pretty much in the last decade, commodities languished. I mean, I don't care if it was base metals, if it was oil, the prices fell, profitability fell in the industry. The industry contracted, and we'll talk about some of the significance of that in just a moment. But I think the real big driver, and one of the things that we see, is it's going to be ESG. And secondly, we have major deficits. I don't care if you're talking about a tight oil market, a tight metals market. Inventory levels are below their five-year averages. I haven't seen them this low. You'd almost have to go back two decades.
Now, Jim, as many of our long-term listeners will know, you made a big call on commodities in 2020, predicting that we would see a massive wave of inflation and that you were telling our listeners and clients that the smart money were preparing for this big wave of inflation that would be coming down the pike, as we all see today. The smart money would be preparing for that by hedging these inflationary forces by moving into hard assets, precious metals, energy, agriculture, basically anything that you typically see move up in an inflationary period. Now there's been much more concern over recession, and perhaps the narrative is switching from having much of a greater concern over inflation over perhaps the deflationary consequences of a recession. Where do you see commodities currently, given the short-term weakness that we've seen in light of some of these recessionary fears?
Well, let's take the biggest commodity. Let's take oil. Typically, I mean, if you take a look at what the administration is doing, they're dumping vast amounts of oil into the market to cap it ahead of the midterm elections. I think the last release was 20 million barrels, and we're releasing more than a million barrels a day, especially with the 20 million barrel dump. That helped to bring the price of oil down. So that's capping oil right now. We can see oil maybe getting down to the $80 level on West Texas Intermediate crude. But we're also entering in at the end of August, we enter into what we call the shoulder months of the year. The summer driving season's over, so there's less gasoline demand. Refineries are going to switch over and get ready for winter demand, which will be heating oil and things like natural gas that are going to be used to heat homes. And also during September and October, Chris, it's a very nice time of the year. There's less energy demand. The weather is still nice outside. So there is a two-month period of time where actually oil prices should go down seasonality-wise because we're using less energy during those 2 months. But we see this picking up, especially after October, when after the midterm elections, I assume the Biden administration will stop draining the strategic petroleum reserves because they're doing it to cap prices ahead of the election. What do they do after the election? I mean, we don't want to get ourselves in a very dangerous position where we basically deplete all of our spare reserves, which leaves us very vulnerable to weather-related events like hurricanes or, as we've seen with the Ukraine war, a geopolitical event, which there's opportunity for many of those. So you have that. The second thing that you have going on is if you take a look at copper, you take a look at some of the other base metals, which have fallen down on recessionary fears, it's not reflective, Chris, of the supply deficits and the low inventory levels that are well below five-year averages. And if you take a look at that, we're not finding any more major copper deposits. And as we move into ESG, now you take a look at this new massive spending bill, and we'll talk about inflation here in just a minute. It's basically, they call it the anti-inflation bill, which is Orwellian in nature because this is going to spike inflation. But there's trillions of dollars that they're going to put into the green economy, whether it's charging stations, windmills, solar panels, all that. They're going to give credits for buying electric cars. All of that is going to create this demand that's going to be being pushed by the government, because we're literally talking, Chris, I think roughly about $2.5 trillion that they're talking about passing here in the next week or so. So all of that is going to create this demand. Like I said, one of the big drivers that we're going to see this decade is going to be ESG. And then a second driver is going to be something that we talked about in the program a number of weeks ago with Peter Zeihan on deglobalization. So you're seeing in this chip bill incentives being created to bring manufacturing back here. We live in this modern technological world where everything is run on electronics, but all those electronics and chips are being made overseas. So strategically, we're bringing manufacturing back here. That's going to create more demand for materials as we begin to manufacture more of the things we used to do, but outsourced with globalization beginning in the 70s. So that's changing the dynamics. And then as Peter talked about in his book, The End of the World is Just the Beginning, he talked about as the world restructures, as the U.S. pulls back from being the world's policeman, the seas are going to be more dangerous. In other words, the U.S., since World War II, policed the seas with our Navy and basically said, look, anybody can trade in the international markets, we'll protect the seaways. Well, now we're receding from that. We don't have any carriers in the Persian Gulf anymore. Most of our carrier battle group is mainly towards Asia now. And so that is also going to contribute to this cycle as well.
So, Jim, in the long term, you're still bullish on commodities and you believe that there's a pretty strong case that we're in the beginning of a longer term commodity upcycle. This is something that you wrote discussing Jeff Currie's framework for how this is going to evolve. He believes that we're in the first phase, and this is the beginning stage. It's also a point where we do see more volatility in the commodity complex because there's still a lot of traders moving in and out. However, as demand starts to grow and provide an institutional bid behind this trend, that is going to lower the amount of volatility as we move into the second and third phases of this commodity cycle. But that is the long-term outlook. In the short term, as we know, you know, commodities are more volatile than the broader market. And in this case, they have been hit in the near term after a really strong move from 2020. So now let's move, since there is such a close tie to commodities inflation, tell us, what's your outlook on inflation at present? Obviously, we just saw the last print was 9.1%. CPI year over year. Other measures like Trueflation, which looks at 10 million items across the U.S., are lining up closer to around 10%. But what is your outlook moving forward?
I think, Chris, inflation is continuing, and we're in a unique period of time, very similar to where we were in 2018. In 2017, President Trump passed a Stimulus Jobs Act bill, which lowered taxes, and the purpose was to stimulate the economy, bring manufacturing back. At the same time, the Trump administration was putting fiscal policy into work in terms of the economy. You had the Federal Reserve that was raising interest rates. Everybody remembers the tweets that President Trump would kind of assail Chairman Powell. It's like, I'm trying to get the economy stimulated and you're trying to raise interest rates and curb it. So there was a conflict between fiscal policy and monetary policy. Now, eventually, Powell pivoted, especially when weakness came in on the economy and the markets began to crater. He flipped, went to zero, began printing money. Fast forward to where we are today. With the pandemic, the government spent $7 trillion to stimulate the economy after shutting it down and putting people out of work and destroying what I think it was over 300,000 small businesses. Now, we have to go to Biden comes in. The first thing he does is pass a stimulus bill of $2 trillion at a time the economy was roaring coming back from the lockdowns. And that created a lot of the inflation that you see today, because what's the definition of inflation? Too much money chasing too few goods. So we were putting more money, and this time we were doing helicopter drops. We were actually writing checks and giving people checks to spend money. At the same time, the lockdowns were destroying businesses and cutting supply. So now, right now, there's two bills. The one is the Inflation Reduction Act, which is kind of Orwellian in nature because it's not anti-inflationary, it's inflationary. So that's $2 trillion. Then you have the CHIP bill, which is $400 billion. So now the government is going to spend an additional $2.4 trillion, shove that into the economy. At the same time, you have Fed policy that's trying to control inflation while fiscal policy is highly inflationary. So the two are in conflict, very much like they were in 2018, with Trump's stimulus bill, the Fed was raising interest rates. Now you have a new stimulus bill on top of the one that was passed last year, and then the Fed is raising interest rates. So the two are butting heads. And Chris, I just don't see the Fed raising the Fed funds rate to 4 or 5%. I think the futures market is saying 3.5%. So if you look at this coming September, you could see another possible 0.75 point, especially if inflation remains elevated. And that would take the Fed funds rate to 3%. They're saying it's going to 3.5%, which would mean probably another 0.5 point rate hike coming in December. So, Chris, inflation is not going away. This is going to be an inflationary, highly inflationary decade. Maybe they get inflation down to the 5 or 6% range, but there's no way they're going to get it down to 2%. What the Fed would have to do would be so drastic, and fiscal policy in Washington would have to change, which it's not about to do. So I see inflation on the horizon this entire decade. I mean, you take a look at, and by the way, this is both Democrats and Republicans. I mean, let's not forget the economy was growing under Trump, and he was running trillion-dollar deficits, just as Biden is running trillion-dollar deficits, just as Obama ran trillion-dollar deficits. So this MMT, this modern monetary theory, basically says you can spend and borrow as much money as you want as long as it's done in your own currency. We see a dollar breakdown coming ahead. Right now, the dollar has been exceptionally strong. Basically, if you're in Europe, it's a mess, and I worry about what's going to happen to Europe this winter. But where are you going to put your money? You've got problems in Asia. You've got problems in Europe. So a lot of that money, there's actually a shortage of dollars. So a lot of that money has been going into the dollar in the treasury market, where yields here are so much higher than any other place on the planet, other than maybe Latin America. But just take a look at all the central banks now. England's raising, Canada's raising, South America's raising interest rates. The U.S. is basically exporting inflation. So if you take a look at the rising dollar in terms of where it is now, what does that mean? If the dollar is rising and you're a European dealing in euros, that means the euro is going down, which means you're paying more for everything from commodities. The yen is going down, which means you're paying more to buy commodities or anything else. So the U.S., in a way, is exporting inflation by the strong dollar, which makes weaker currencies overseas, which means their inflation rates are at all-time levels. I mean, you've got the Bank of England raising rates, the European Central Bank. It's global, and that's why the they're taking a look at that contraction globally. But, Chris, what they're not taking into effect is all of these massive green mandates. And we saw this backfire in Sri Lanka, where they went to organic farming. It created food shortages, and they rioted, took over the presidential palace. You've got the same thing going on in Denmark, trying to reduce their gas emissions. Probably one out of three farms in Denmark will be put out of business. And that's important because you have, with the Ukrainian war, you have the Russians, which account for 25% of the global export of wheat. You've got Denmark, which is a major agricultural exporter. You've got Canada, which is doing following the same policies. And then in the U.S., you have these large billionaire groups that are buying large swaths of U.S. farmland, and they're going to take that farmland out of production and turn it into wildlife preserves, which basically you're shrinking the amount of farmland that's going to produce grains and related thing, everything from corn to soybeans to everything else. So all of this, our policies with ESG is pushing and is going to be the big driver, not only of inflation, but also one of the biggest bull markets in commodities we're going to see in our lifetime. It reminds me of one of the sayings that Jim Cramer often says on his program. He said, you look around, there's always a bull market somewhere. Well, there may not be a bull market in financial assets. And I want you to think back to what happened to the stock market in the year 2000. Basically, in 2000 to 2002, we lost over 50% in the stock market, in the S&P. The NASDAQ lost over 70. That ended in 2002. It took another 5 years to get us back up to where we were in January of 2000. In September of 2007, another bear market began where the S&P lost 60%, and it wouldn't be until 2013 when you broke even. So for 13 years, basically the stock market went nowhere, and during that period of time, it was the ultimate period for commodities. Commodities peaked in 2011. That's when we dumped our silver and gold, got out, and we went into financial assets. So, Chris, every market cycle has its drivers, its industry that becomes the top performer. If you take a look at the 80s, it was conglomerates. The 90s was technology. The 00 decade was commodities. The last decade was financial assets. I don't care if it was stocks or bonds, you made money. This decade, the bull market is going to be in commodities.
So, Jim, as I mentioned earlier, you discussed Jeff Currie's framework for how this commodity bull market cycle is likely to unfold through a number of different phases. He believes that we're in this first phase. Would you mind articulating that or explaining how he sees this proceeding moving forward?
Well, if you take a look at what basically has happened, what's kept money out of this sector, ESG, poor profitability. Remember, oil was in a bear market from 2014, and actually in 2020, it actually went negative. And then volatility. And let me talk a little bit about volatility here. If you take a look at commodities, their market cap in terms of the regular cycle, they represent a small portion of the S&P index. And I did a sample of this, and I talked about the market caps of the largest mining companies, the largest oil companies, and the largest precious metal companies. So I took BHP, Rio, Exxon, Chevron, Barrick, and Newmont. Their market cap added together, Chris, is little over $1 trillion. By comparison, Apple has a market cap of $2.6 trillion. So you could take the mining and oil industry, add them up together, and they're probably less than the market cap of Apple. So you do have some large cap companies. I mean, if you take a look at Exxon, it's a $400 billion company, Chevron, a $300 billion company, but BHP, less than $200 billion, Rio, less than $100 billion, Newmont, $35 billion, Barrick, $28 billion. So you're talking about the largest companies, their market cap is so fractional of what the rest of the market is, it doesn't take a lot of money that comes into this sector that begins to push it up. Now, let's talk about Jeff Currie, who's the main commodity strategist at Goldman Sachs, one of the sharpest people I follow in the commodity space. And one of the things he talks about how this develops is you take a look at a bull market. What happens in the first phase? That's when the smart money comes into the sector. It usually lasts 2 to 3 years. They see the value. They see the catalyst that could turn it around. So that's phase one. Phase two is when institutions come in. And I was listening to an interview that Jeff Currie did, and it finally dawned on him why you have phase one and phase two, because basically your asset allocators, your fund managers, your institutions don't like to come into a sector until they see at least 3 years of consistent profitability, because they're not going to go into a sector if you have 1 year you make money, the following year you don't. So if you have 3 years of increasing profitability, you enter phase two, which is when the institutions come in, and that's where you really get a lot of money. Capital starts coming into the sector. As money comes into the sector, the market caps increase and you get more stability in the sector because of money flows. Phase three, which is another 3 years, you're probably halfway through the cycle, and that gets on the radar of retail investors. Retail investors say, oh my God, oil stocks have doubled and tripled, and they're following momentum. Phase three is individual investors come into the sector as momentum comes in and the sector becomes hot. And then finally, you get the final phase, which is phase four, where government changes its policies to solve the bottlenecks that are in industry, whether it's, you know, making it easier to drill for oil, easier to open up a mine. And that ushers in the final phase of the commodity cycle, the bull market. And that's where you get the blow-off phase. Valuations become overstretched. Think of what commodity prices were on many of the mining companies and oil companies in 2008 and 2011. And that's when the smart money begins to exit this trade. Based on the supply deficits, based on ESG, he sees this cycle lasting 12 to 15 years. I could easily see it going over a decade, Chris. So that's the typical cycle that we see played out in the commodity space. And I just see, Chris, we are in the early stages of this. And here's the nice thing. As Greg Orrell said earlier in the broadcast, he talked about the mining industry has never been in better shape. After the bear market that began in 2011, mining companies reduced debt. They got their balance sheets up to grade. So you have low debt ratios. I mean, Chris, mining stocks today, and I'm talking about gold miners, are paying 4 to 5% dividend. You've got companies like Newmont that are buying back 5% of their stock. You're seeing it also in the oil sector. And they've never been in better shape entering a bull market. And so I think, you know, if you're a patient investor, the great thing, whether you're buying oil, whether you're buying metals, you're buying miners, is the dividend yields range anywhere from 4 to 11 and 12%. So you're being paid handsomely to wait till everybody else catches on to what you're doing when the phase two of the market begins in the when the institutions start coming in after profitability. Even though gold is at 1800 or close to 1800, these companies are making a lot of money. Oil companies are making a lot of money. And Chris, there's a reluctance right now by miners. There's a reluctance now by oil companies to make any investments. The IEA says by 2026, oil demand will increase by another 10 million barrels, and we need to be making trillions and trillions of dollars of new investment if we want to have the oil to meet those growth demands in the economy. And we're not doing it, because if you're an oil company, why are you going to do it? The anti-inflation bill puts a new tax on oil in oil companies. So, I mean, what's the incentive to do that? I mean, a year ago, you were being dragged before Congress and you were being encouraged to divest yourself of your oil assets. A year later, with spiking oil prices, they're asking you to produce more. You can't do this flip-flop. And that's where, as Jeff Currie talks about, policy is very important. And that usually comes in the final phase of the bull market. We saw this, for example, in Mexico, as Mexico's largest oil field, Canarel, ran out of oil. What you saw Mexico do is open up their land to mining. So if you were a foreign miner, a Canadian miner, U.S. company, you could come into Mexico, own the land, mine for minerals, whether gold, silver, or something else. Of course, the government was making royalties on this, and it helped to replace the lost revenues from oil. They also opened up their oil fields to Western companies because they weren't putting any money in to develop their oil infrastructure. So now in Mexico, you can mine and own land in Mexico. The Western oil companies are coming in and working with Pemex to develop oil fields or find new oil fields. And that is what happens when you get into the final stages where you see rising commodity prices. Government changes policy, but we're far ways away from that. Right now, it's basically anti-fossil fuels, anti-mining, and it's going to stay that way probably, Chris, until we just get that huge, huge run-up in all these prices that are going to ripple through the economy in inflationary tailwinds. And I see that a lot of that developing here over the next couple of years.
So, Jim, in sum, as we discussed today, you believe that we are, as Jeff Currie, Goldman Sachs top commodity strategist, also believes that we are in the beginning stages of a longer-term bull market cycle. Commodities are inherently volatile. They saw a really big run from 2020 up until recently this year. So a cooling off period is natural. But it sounds like you would say that long-term investors should still be looking at commodities as a long-term investment within the context of a larger bull market.
Oh, absolutely. Because at some point, Chris, the Fed's going to have to pivot. They keep raising interest rates in the way they're doing. And, you know, if this bill gets passed, which is likely, they're going to vote on it next week. That is really going to push trillions of new money into the economy, which is going to be inflationary. But the Fed is walking a tightrope. If they raise interest rates too much, they run the risk of collapsing the economy. I mean, you've seen it. One of the big investment banks just laid off 50,000 employees today. You had Walmart laying off 200 executives. You're seeing just day after day, whether it's Netflix, Walmart, companies are beginning the layoffs. And once again, layoffs and the unemployment rate is a lagging economic indicator. So look for layoffs and the unemployment rate to rise going forward. A lot of the employment market has been distorted as a result of the lockdown and the pandemic. A lot of those workers are now coming back into the workforce. And even though, you know, you take a look at wages are up 5%, it's not helping people when you have inflation running 10%. And unfortunately, Chris, even the people at the Fed, you had the San Francisco Fed governor come out this week and said, she's not hurting. She goes, you know, this inflation isn't affecting me. I make enough money. Well, yeah, she makes $423,000. And she said, most Americans have enough money that this is going to impact them. And the ones that are, well, she said, just do a staycation or go camping instead of your regular vacation and stop eating out. I mean, it's these people are in such a bubble and out of touch with reality that, you know, they just don't see it. And, You know, in my experience in my career in over 40 years in this business, I've only seen, Chris, one soft landing. That was 94. The Fed doubled the Fed funds rate from 3 to 6. The markets kind of reacted. Stocks fell, bonds fell. But by the end of the year, they were back to even. And we weren't in a recession. Of course, the technology cycle was just beginning. I don't see any of those type of catalysts here. So anyway, I look for a higher inflation. This will be the decade to own hard stuff. And even when it comes to real estate, as we've talked with Rick Sharga at Adam Data, we are short about 4 to 5 million houses as the millennial generation comes in and is in their prime home buying market. So even though real estate may soften short term, we see real estate being a good investment in this decade as an inflation hedge, as well as commodities. And as I say, Chris, I think we're just at the beginning of this cycle. So hold on to your seat. Lots of ways to make money in this decade.
So, Jim, with that said, I do want to point out to all of our listeners that Financial Sense News Hour is, of course, sponsored by our money management company, Financial Sense Wealth Management. And we have been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. So what would be the best way for our listeners to contact us and to learn more about our services?
Well, there's two ways. They can call our toll-free number, 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Or you can go to our website, financialsense.com.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.